the Hittite Empire, a phenomenal empire of incredible strength. Now, the story of how we found the Hittites, how we uncovered the civilization, is truly an amazing thing. I want to spend a little bit of time on this because it's important to realize that think of it now, 150 years ago, that's like nothing. 150 years ago, we knew nothing about these people. The greatest minds of the time, you had the great movement of philosophes in France. The philosophes, intellectual thinkers, would get together, and that's where Voltaire comes from, and these great thinkers, and they begin putting things together into encyclopedias. And Diderot was one of the greatest of the early encyclopedists, and he put all this different information. It's a time of growing in knowledge, the Enlightenment movement, we call it in history. Okay, now listen, while this is happening, all of these things are happening, these incredible encyclopedias are being gathered together, telling us about where a man for the first time can open up Diderot's encyclopedia. And now Diderot was a humanist, to say the least, but he gathered all this information and he put his own slant on it. But the thing is, they could look up, for example, the Assyrian nation, and there would be an entry on it, just like the Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, I want to show you, and I got a hold of this, I want to show you what an entry from the French Encyclopédie, which was the primary encyclopedia of this time, what they had to say about the Hittites. Okay? This is 1871. 1871, a little over 100 years ago. Here's what they said. Under the heading for Hittite, it said, Canaanite tribe encountered by the Israelites in Palestine, dwelt in the vicinity of Hebron along with the Amorites. Later, they were found together in the north in the region of Bethel, at which time they were made a tributary to Solomon. Still later, an independent Hittite tribe under a monarchic government lived even further to the north near Syria. That's it. Seven lines on this people that ruled much of the known world for over 600 years. The sound of the Hittite chariots was so phenomenally disturbing that when a town would hear the rumble of the chariots, we'll see tonight, when they would hear the rumble of the chariots, the first thing, they wouldn't even take time to pack. They would grab the kids and they're out of there, because it was one of the most ferocious sounding things in the world. The Hittites were incredibly powerful warriors, and we'll see why tonight. Now, in the year 1835, there's a man by the name of Texier. Texier is not a Texan, he's a Frenchman. And he's got quite a bit of money, and he's living under the reign of good King Philippe. And he decides that he wants to uncover an ancient civilization by the name of Tavium. Tavium is an ancient town that was in Asia Minor, which was built by Gaul, by the Gaelic peoples, and it was conquered by the Celtic peoples during the Roman Empire, during Roman times. Now, if you know anything about ancient history, a little bit later on, you know that Gaul is ancient France. What we call France today is ancient Gaul. So he being a Frenchman, had a vested interest in wanting to know more about his history, and the ancient archaic French people, the Gauls, had built this this town, Tavium. So he travels during the reign of King Louis Philippe, and he gets to Asia Minor. And I didn't color it in for you, and I should have, but there's a river right here, the Halys River. It goes right up through here, just like this. Now, I gave you a map on the back, and I think you can see it better. How did it come out? Okay, you see that? Good. All right. I haven't seen the handouts yet. But the Halys River is a river. There's no navigable. How do you say that? You're sure? That's how you say it. A river that you can navigate in all of Turkey or Anatolia, okay? But this river is very important. This river, near this river, we have Tavium is over here. Tavium, you see where my finger is? That's Tavium. You can barely see it. Let me use this. Tavium is over here. Well, he knows that, he understands that the Tavium is in the vicinity somewhere. So he goes into Turkey and he begins asking around and talking to people. And he ends up in a place that we know as Hattus or Hattusus. In your book, it calls it Hattusus. Okay? The real name for the place is Boaz Kui. Boaz Kui is an extremely important piece of the Hittite puzzle. Boaz Kui is a town now. This guy goes into this town and he's looking for Tavium. And he's looking all around and he's talking to people. All of a sudden, he begins to see some things. Now, I want to read this to you, and it's a little bit lengthy, so I'm really going to ask. I know the way it usually goes is the minute anybody starts reading, it's like time to catch up on some sleep in the audience. But really try to stick with this, because this is phenomenal. This guy goes to discover this place called Tavium, Taxier, and watch what happens, okay? Let me just get there. Okay, listen to this. There's no way I could say this better. I just think the way they explain it is awesome. So listen to this. Searching for the ancient town of Tavium, where invading Celts had settled in Roman times, Texier collected a few hints in the village of Boaz Kui and decided to check them out. He clambered up a rutted road lined with crumbling mud hovels, ascended higher and higher into more and more rugged hills, and suddenly, there before him lay gigantic blocks of stone in long straight rows. Though worn by centuries of time, they had an unmistakable outline of a building, a huge, strangely rambling, complex layout. He climbed on, and he came upon the remains of a fortification wall and paced it off. It was miles long. Now listen to this. He's astonished right here, because he automatically knows that this is no small village. This is not the village of Tavium. There's a fortification wall that's going on for miles. Listen to this. When he reached the peak of the hill, he paused and let his eyes sweep over the view. Mentally, he drew a circle around the ruins in sight, and he recognized that these ruins must have formed a city as large as Athens was in the height of its glory. He walked on until he found two mighty gates in the wall. On one of them, he beheld the figure of a man carved in relief. Perhaps it was a king. The figure was of superhuman size, the carving done in a strange manner like nothing he had ever seen before. The other gate was ornamented with statues of lions. He attempted to draw these and also had his companions make some sketches. Texier promptly made a stab at interpretation. This is what he says. Now, this is a quote from Texier. He wrote, "Wholly possessed by the idea of finding ancient Tavium, I was inclined to take these ruins for the Temple of Jupiter with the sanctuary mentioned by Strabo. But I later found myself compelled to abandon this opinion," he wrote. And then he confessed, "No evidence of any Roman era could be fitted in here. The grandeur and the peculiar nature of the ruins perplexed me extraordinarily when I attempted to give a city a historical name." Texier, however, once more studied his source material on Tavium, and he came to the conclusion that the mysterious city could not possibly have been Tavium, and declared his conviction that it was Tiera, where Croesus and Cyrus had fought their famous battle. Let me just stop for one second. We will talk about that more when we get to the Persians. But this is an unbelievable battle that was fought between Croesus and Cyrus, and these two kings, the Persian king Cyrus and Croesus. Croesus decided that he was not going to proceed in battle until he consulted the oracle at Delphi, which was a demonic place where they went to find out the future. And there was a demon there, and the demon used to literally give them information about the future. And so he went there. Oh, I'm giving away the whole Persian thing. Anyway, he went there, and he gets to the Oracle of Delphi, and he says to the Oracle, he says, "If I go to war, what will happen?" And here's what the Oracle tells him: "If you proceed in battle, a great nation will fall." And he says, "I've got them. I've got them." And he goes, and he enters battle, and he gets creamed, and a great nation did fall his. So it's one of the great stories of history. Okay, then he continues. Now, I want to continue with this. It's not much longer, but listen to this now. Figure this. He's walking through these places, and all of a sudden, it's going to get tighter and tighter, and he's going to be shown another place. And wait, listen to what he sees. But other surprises were in store for Texier. Let me tell you about them. A native led him away from Boaz Kui along a difficult path cut diagonally across deep incised river valleys. They climbed a good 2 hours until they reached a plateau opposite the hill which he had seen the ruined city. And there he found a place which is called today the Inscribed Rock, or Yarazlaka. Precipitous cliffs mounted skyward here, and between them a broad cleft formed a natural chamber. Here a stone cliff wall had been somewhat smoothed, but on its surface was carved strange sculptures. Texier saw gods moving. Listen to what he sees. He sees these gigantic blocks. Think of it. All of a sudden, he's like, this is an archaeologist now looking for a little city of Tavium, and he sees these gigantic blocks, and carved on the blocks are these god men, superhuman-sized god men with pointed hats, dressed different, unbelievably, all marching in a procession. And the wall goes on and on and on and on. And it's a gigantic procession of these warriors, stone warriors carved with rude faces. I want you to look in your book. Don't look there now. But when you get home, look in your book under that little pitiful section they give you on the Hittites. And you're going to see some of the reliefs that I'm talking about. The warriors carved into the stone. They'll show you like one of the many that are going in the row here. Now look at what he says. Texier saw gods moving in stiff, solemn processions across these walls, their heads crowned with pointed caps, their garments girded at the waist. He followed the cliff around a gentle turn to the right and saw more sculptures, figures with different types of dress wearing tiaras instead of pointed caps. Two of the figures were winged. The others held unrecognizable objects in their hands or stood upon the necks of still other figures who were followed by animals. Stunned by these strange processions in stone, Texier looked for an exit. Then he noticed on his narrow left a passage to a small cliff in the rock. At the entrance, he paused. Two winged demons cut into the stone on either side of the passage seemed to be warding off any intruders. Isn't this great? I love the way this guy writes this. Nevertheless, he hesitantly went through and beheld another procession on the steep west wall. 12 warriors, or were they gods, were marching stiff-legged, one behind the other, going forward with deadly purposiveness. 12 men on parade, on their heads tall pointed caps, and on their shoulders scimitars. Diagonally across, a tall figure held a smaller one in protective embrace. Above its outstretched arm was a flower-like shape composed of several signs resembling hieroglyphs. Obviously symbols, but for what? Texier looked around, then returned to the larger chamber. Here he observed still more of these signs. Some of them were so worn by time that he could scarcely make them out. Were these marks or merely ornament? Or were they perhaps a script? Texier made his way back to the entrance, standing there and gazing over the plateau that lay before him. He perceived the remains of the walls. Had there been buildings here? Gateworks guarding the entrance to the cliff in the rock? And as he looked, it became for him a virtual certainty that he stood in front of an ancient sanctuary, a highly unusual temple in the rocks. But built by whom? For the worship of what people? He looked across the valley toward the ruins of Bogaz Kui, gazed at the gullies and the jagged ridges upon which the sun blazed inexorably. God must have worked with clenched fists when he molded this landscape. Now, that's quite a find. That's quite a description of it as well. That's in a book that's been out of print for many, many years, which I was blessed to find at a library down near in Woonsocket. And I tried everywhere to get this book, and I ended up making a copy of the entire book so that I could have it in my library. Now, think of it. He uncovers this civilization, and he has no idea who they are, what they are, where they belong. Well, our story continues. What happens is we get a gentleman by the name of Archibald Henry Sace around 1879. Sace is only 34 years old at the time, but he's already the leading Orientalist in the world. He's an absolute genius in every sense of the word. And he driven by nothing but his own personal study of the Bible, he calls a meeting in London, and he stands before the Society for Archaeological Biblical Research, and he makes a statement that shakes the archaeological world. He says, I have looked at the evidence, I've looked at the different things that have been found throughout the throughout Syria and throughout Asia Minor, and I've come to this conclusion. We have uncovered the Hittite civilization. And he was literally laughed right out of the profession. He was literally laughed right out. The Hittites? You mean that hill people? The hillbillies? You mean those people that play such an insignificant part in the Bible? You mean the that's crazy. And purely on guesswork alone, he's one of the most ridiculed men who have ever been an archaeologist, as far as we know, because he made this statement and he was bold enough. Now, granted, he didn't have a whole lot of proof when he made this. Everything that he said was based on biblical studies alone. Okay. Then all of a sudden, a guy by the name of Winkler, Hugo Winkler, a German scholar, found thousands of tablets at Bogaz Kui. He heads down into Asia Minor again, and at Bogaz Kui, which is about 90 miles away from Ankara, right near that great big bend in the Halys River, he goes to Bogaz Kui, and what he does is when he's there, he finds thousands of cuneiform clay tablets. And he is an absolute brilliant mind. He's a philologist and a linguist, and he sits down, and all he does is he has people bring him in tablets constantly. And as he reads them, he translates them. However, there were two kinds of tablets. One he read very easily because it was written in Akkadian script. Remember Akkadia? Right in up here? I mean down here when we studied the Sumerians? You had the Sumerians, and then to the north were the Akkadians. Sargon the First was the Akkadian king. Ring a bell? Okay, the Akkadians, it was written in Akkadian script, and because he was such a phenomenal philologist, he was able to just decipher these things. Now, here's the problem. All of a sudden, he comes across these other cuneiform tablets, which he can't do anything with, and he devotes the rest of his life to studying these tablets and cannot crack the code. So then he died. Well, now this is about the 1900s. We're at the beginning of the century, and a little bit of time goes by, and now we're into World War I, and there is an absolutely brilliant scholar at the who's the head of the Languages of Antiquity in Vienna, and this this scholar is drafted into the Austrian army during World War I. Well, it becomes very clear his lieutenant that he's assigned to is also a very very interested in ancient studies, and he's talking a lot to this man. And by the way, this man's name is Frederick Horanzi. Horanzi. Isn't that what a name, huh? Horanzi. But he's a Czech, and he was born in Poland of Czech parents. But this great genius is assigned to this lieutenant's division. And the lieutenant begins to tell him all of these things that he's been studying and all this. And so they're near Berlin. So what happens is the lieutenant keeps cutting this guy some leave, recognizing him as a great genius of philology. He begins cutting him all kinds of leave so that he can go into Berlin. When Winkler, the guy who had discovered all these tablets, the ones he couldn't read, he took many of them back to Berlin. And he died there. Okay, what happens is Horanzi gets this leave to go into Berlin, and all the time he's going back and forth, and he's trying to crack Hittite cuneiform. And by the time World War I is over, he cracks it, and this opens up a vast library of information. And all of a sudden, we realize that what the Bible had always said is absolutely correct. They were a mighty, mighty empire. Now, is that a tremendous story? Okay, now listen to this. I've taken a lot of time in this study to try and figure out the best way to present this. To do it chronologically, would there's just too much information there. Most of the names would be lost on you. So what we're going to try to do is just take some principles and try and give you a taste of what these people are like and plug it into the Word of God. Okay, the first principle that I want to give you is obviously that they were fierce warriors. The biggest thing about this, them being fierce warriors, is they had an invention that no one else really in the world had back then, and that was the formula to smelt iron. So they had iron weapons, and with this iron weapons, they also did something else. They made very fast chariots. extremely fast chariots. And with these they set up these chariots. It was basically a two-wheel chariot made of iron wheels, which made it extremely durable. Three men rode on a chariot, and it would be pulled by a yoke of either two or four horses. Now, at this time, we have a lot of movement in the area because a lot of people are understanding horses here. We have the Kassites who will later come down and invade Babylonia. That's one tribe. We have another group of people called the Hurrians who are going to settle over here. And they go to India, and they've got some cousins over in India who are Aryans. And from the Aryans, they learn an unbelievable vast information about horses. So they come back, and we have basically three nations, the Hurrians. Now listen carefully. The Hurrians, the Hittites, and the Kassites are three nations who are extremely gifted in equestrian arts. As a matter of fact, when we uncovered the, I say we, like I had something to do with deciphering Hittite cuneiform, when they deciphered Hittite cuneiform, they found tablet upon tablet, the oldest known guidebook to the equestrian arts, to the study of horses, breeding horses, was found in these Hittite cuneiforms at Bogaz Kui. Okay? So over 1,000 lines just on how to train horses. Isn't that amazing? So they understood the chariot, and they understood the horse as an unbelievable weapon. So here's what they did. These three nations I'm telling you about, these three groups of people, the Hurrians, the Kassites, and the Hittites, groups, a few people, rebels from these groups, tough guys, you know, rogues, get together, and they band together, and they become a group of people known as, see if you've ever heard of these people before, the Hyksos. You know the Hyksos? What did they end up doing? These guys were so tough that they ended up subduing Egypt for a couple hundred years. These are tough guys. You know, these are tough warriors. You really have to get this through your head and understand that how tough these guys were. So they had the smelting device. They had unbelievably quick chariots, which made them very dangerous. And at the same time, they were fierce warriors, okay? I want you to look with me, turn in your Bibles, if you would, to 2 Kings chapter 7. 2 Kings chapter 7. And go quickly, because we have quite a bit to cover. I think we can do it, but we do want to try to get everything in. 2 Kings chapter 7. And I'm going to show you the passage that if only these people, the archaeologists would have read carefully, they could have seen just how powerful the Hittites actually were. This is a story. Now, I can't go into the background of this chapter. If you want to study it on your own, you can do that. But I want you to look at the story of four lepers. There are four lepers. Let me tell you really quickly. There are four lepers, and they're sitting there, and they realize they're going to starve to death, and they're in the middle of a war situation, and they say, hey, what are we going to do? Why don't we go and give ourselves over to the enemies, into their camp? Because, hey, let's face it, it's either that or maybe they'll spare our lives and feed us. It's either that or we're going to starve to death. They're between a rock and a hard place. And look at what happened. Look at what happens. They end up going into the camp and I'll tell you what, go to verse 4. If we say, now here are the four lepers, they're sitting there, they're ostracized by society, nobody's going to give them a cheeseburger. Look at this. If we say we will enter the city, then famine is in the city, and we shall die there. If we sit here, we will die also. Now therefore, come, let us go over to the camp of the Arameans. If they spare us, we shall live. If they kill us, we shall but die. We're going to die anyway. And look what happens. Verse 5. And they arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Arameans. And when they had come to the outskirts of the camp of the Arameans, behold, there was no one there. They go into this camp of the Arameans, and guess what the Arameans had done? Run away. All their stuff is there. And these four lepers are going to be the four richest lepers in the world by the time they get through with this. Look at this. And look at what happens. This is unbelievable. I love this. I'll tell you. Okay, look at this. For the Lord, it says, there was no one there. Verse 6, for the Lord had caused the army of the Arameans to hear a sound of chariots and the sound of horses, even the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. Therefore, they arose and fled in the twilight, and they left their tents and their horses and their donkeys, even the camp that was, even just as it was, and they fled for their life. Now, you think that the ancient world, do you think that these people were afraid of these tribes? Do you know what 2,000, listen, at the battle of Kadesh, they had 3,500 chariots. The Hittites, 3,500, do you know what the rumble of 3,500 chariots hooked up on a yoke of 2 to 4 horses per chariot with archers and spear throwers on the chariots? Come on. Can you imagine the... They just run away. They're not going to stand. They're not going to wait there and see who's behind it. Maybe they're friendly. They're coming kind of fast. As Norm would say, that's not fantastic. Okay, so you can see how powerful that they were. The next point that I want to make, the first point was that they were extremely mighty. The second point that I want to make is that they were noble, courteous, kindly, and just. That sounds like an inconsistency, doesn't it? These were noble people. They were kind. Turn to Genesis chapter 23, quickly, please. Genesis chapter 23, and we'll see this. They were extremely... They had a set of laws that made Hammurabi's code look ridiculous. It was probably the most objective law... And that's Genesis chapter 23. It was probably the most objective law in all of the ancient world, and stood only under the law of Moses, which was given by God himself. Extremely fair. Women enjoyed a very high social position within the Hittite Empire. They were not treated as they were in other nations. For example, what happens like in India, and I mean women are nothing over there in the Far East. But they were honored. Matter of fact, if I'm the king, and therefore my wife is the queen, and I die and my son becomes the king, or actually anybody could become the king in that nation. But if my son becomes the king, his wife cannot become the queen until my mother dies. So that's the kind of respect that they had for women. They were extremely, as I said, kind. Look at Genesis chapter 23. What happened is Sarah has just died. No weeping, please. It was a long time ago. Then Abraham, in verse 3, rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, the Hittites, right? Saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Please give me a burial site from among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. And the sons of Heth answered to him, Abraham, saying to him, Hear us, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of the graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. And then it goes on where Ephron has a field and a tomb. And look at what he says to Abraham in verse 10. Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even all who went in the gate of his city, saying, No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field. I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. And then Abraham, the chapter goes on, and Abraham insists on paying for it because it's not only his tomb alone, but as you know, Isaac and Jacob and their wives will also be buried there. So he ends up paying the man for it. But isn't that gracious? Does that sound like these? They're nothing like the people we're going to study next week, the Assyrians. They would have said, oh, you've got money? Just give us your money. No tomb. And we'll take care of your dead. They were vicious people. But the sons of Heth, as you can see, they were courteous. They were great warriors, but they were courteous. And you know, isn't that kind of like the United States? We can have the most intense fighting force in the world. I think of my uncle all the time. He's forever telling me about when he was in World War II, when he was just 30 miles outside of Berlin. He was a radio man, and they were actually bivouacked out there in the fields, giving the commands from the front, from the generals to the front lines and everything. And he has so many magnificent stories to tell me. And he said, when World War II broke out, you couldn't sign the men up fast enough. When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Integrity. Fighting men. They said, what? They did what? They bombed Pearl Harbor? Sign me up. Do you know where Bobby is? It's supper time. Bobby's over signing up for the army or something. You couldn't keep men away. Well, what's the difference? What's happened? We'll see when we get into the Roman Empire and the fall of the Roman Empire that what's happened in this country is we've crumbled from within. I really believe today that, if the Russians landed in Vermont, you'd have some people saying, come on now, we can work this out, can't we? Give them Lake Champlain and we'll take the rest. Come on, be serious here. Because the integrity in our nation is gone. The integrity in our nation is gone. No longer. Now, my uncle was a fighting man. He was willing to fight for his country. He had incredible integrity, but he was also very kind. He was a humanitarian. He was a good man, but he realized that as Pastor was saying the other night, freedom is much more important than peace. So anyway, look at this. Isn't that unbelievable how kind that they were? Many times they'd conquer a nation and they'd say, okay, we conquered you. You have to pay us so much money every 6 months or something. And as long as you paid your tribute like you were supposed to, you never heard from the Hittites. If you got captured in war, they would take you in and they would treat you very humanitarianly. They would feed you. They wouldn't torture you and all of these things that we're going to hear about next week, sadly. Okay. Loyalty and integrity. Point three. They were very loyal and they had incredible integrity. I want you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 26. 1 Samuel chapter 26. And we're going to see that David really sought after Hittites because he realized he would see these Hittite warriors and he realized that he'd never seen a Hittite that wasn't a So the thing is, you have, and they set up a capital. These people set up this capital at a place called Bogaz Kui. It's called Hattasus in your book, okay? It's Bogaz Kui. Now, they set up this stronghold here, and it becomes one of the great strongholds of all the world until, I'm going way down in history now just to make sure we get the whole history, the sweep, the overview of Hittite history. What happens is on the Peloponnesus, this is the Peloponnesian Peninsula, up here is Macedonia, and down here is what we know as the Greek mainland, the Gulf of Corinth, and I mean the Isthmus of Corinth, and over here and all this, Athens, Sparta, okay? Here's what happens. The Peloponnesus is invaded by a people that we're going to study in great detail. Don't worry about it right now, but just to explain how this happened. They're invaded by a people from the north, from Upper Macedonia, known as the Dorians, the Dorian Greeks, they become called. And they are very warlike, very imbecilic. All intellectual activity stops when they come on the scene. They kill people and break things, basically. Two things. They kill people and break things. And they come down, and all writing stops, and this is known in history as the Greek Dark Ages. Well, here's what happens. As a result of this, they push the people of the Greek mainland, which the Egyptians called the Greek Sea Peoples, they pushed them into the sea. And what these people do, they had phenomenal navies and boats. What these people do is they end up settling everywhere. They end up, you find some of them over here. Well, if this map continued, you'd have the Iberian Peninsula over here, which is what we know as Spain and Portugal. No, Portugal is not over the Braga Bridge. I hate to break the news to you. But Spain and Portugal is on the Iberian Peninsula. Over here, you had people who actually settled, made a settlement known as Tarsus, which is Greek Sea Peoples. You have other Greek Sea Peoples who are going to come down here and actually try to invade Egypt. Hey, you got to give them a little bit of credit. At least they tried. They didn't do very well. The Greek Sea Peoples came down and tried to invade Egypt, but listen very carefully. The Egyptians, especially Ramses II, ends up pushing them up here, and they become known as the Philistines. They're the Greek... Oh, everybody knew... Yeah. All right, the Philistines are Greek sea peoples who were pushed out by the Dorian invasion, tried to attack Egypt. Hey, they were worshiping the fish god. Remember the fish god, Dagon? So anyway, they push them back up here. They push them back up here and into Philistia, and Palestine gets its whole name from these people. Also, while we just have these Greek sea peoples, over here becomes Phrygia, okay? Phrygia and the Greek Sea Peoples. Now, at this time, here's what happens. Bogaz Kui has been around for some time, and the Greek Sea Peoples come along to the north through Thrace, across the Hellespont, and they actually blow in and they wipe out Hattusis, which shows you how powerful that these people were. It was actually a confederacy of the Greek Sea peoples from coming in from Thrace and from the Aegean, and also the Phrygian peoples who lived, the land dwellers over here, who ended up taking this part of what we will later know as Ionia, a section of Greece. Now listen very carefully. So Hattusis gets wiped out, okay? That's not the end of the Hittites. Their capital is gone. What happens is they settle seven other cities down here, Carchemish being the most famous. So during the time of David now, the Hittites are still, well, maybe not during the later David and Solomon, but toward the beginning, the Hittites still have pockets and they still have strongholds. They're not wiped out, but they're not as strong as they were. They're pushed more south into Syria. Okay? Everybody with me? Okay. All right. So David had some Hittites in his army. Let's look at it, and I'm going to go over this really quickly because... Look at it. 1 Samuel 26, and I want you to look at verse 6. Here's what happened. Let me just give it to you because we're running short on time, and I'll read you just the passage that's pertinent. What happens is David and two of his men, one is a Jew, Abishai, and one is a Hittite. And they come in, and they sneak into the camp. And this is like David's special forces, you know, when they come in. And Abishai's going to open his mouth. Abishai says, "David, God's given you the victory. Let me stab him." And David says, "No." David says, "I'm going to lift my hand against the Lord's anointed." Now, I want you to notice something. You know what the Hittite said? Nothing. He didn't try to be king. He didn't give David bad advice. The only person who gave David bad advice was Abishai the Jew, okay? His own kinsman. But the Hittite, number one, understood authority. Number two, was extremely loyal. Number three, well, he just understood you just don't kill the king. He was on the same wavelength as David, unbelievably loyal. You see that? And I'll just show it to you, prove it to you so that you don't think I made it up. It's in verse 8. Then Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him a second time." And David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?" And look at verse 6. Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, "Who will go down with me to Saul?" So he had the Hittite with him and he had the Hebrew with him. Now go to 2 Samuel and I'll show you one more thing. 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11. And we'll see just one more thing about David and one more great. Now remember, there's only two Hittites that... Now, I want you to think about something. These are two Hittites mentioned in the Word of God in David's army. But these guys aren't foot soldiers. These guys are high-ranking military officials in David's upper echelon. And only two are mentioned. We have to wonder how many were there. Not everybody who was counted there. Only the mighty men as... Mighty men were named there, but what about all of the foot soldiers, those dedicated men who were there fighting with him side by side all of the time? So only two are mentioned, but that doesn't mean that they were only two. Now I want you to just look at this. We all know the story. David ends up taking a look at Bathsheba and he says, "Yow." And he's in the flesh. He stayed home. He should have been out with the army, but he takes a look at her and she was obviously very beautiful. The Bible calls her beautiful, so when the Bible calls you beautiful, you're beautiful. And he falls into sin, and then she ends up getting pregnant. So what he does is he calls Uriah the Hittite, her husband, back. And Uriah the Hittite comes back, and he's perplexed. He comes back, and yes, my lord, well, what is it? We're in the middle of battle. What could be so important? "Oh, Uriah, how you doing? Haven't seen your wife in a while, have you? Listen, I just called you back so that you could, you know, we could have some fellowship together, me and you. Maybe you could, after a while, go to be with your wife." And Uriah, well, just read this, because this is just so phenomenal. And I know that you know it, but let's read it anyway. Look at this. It says in verse 6, David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Joab and the people of the state of war. And David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." Relax. Put your house slippers on. Get the hassock out. And relax, is basically what he's saying. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. Verse 9. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house. This is actually a guard shack, an emergency barracks. In case something happens, it's like a ready alert barracks outside of the palace. And look at what he does. He sleeps at the door of the king's house with all the servants of the Lord, the other people in the barracks, and he did not go to his own house. And when they told David, saying Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a long journey?" "Uriah, I'm not understanding something," he says. "Haven't you just come from a long trip?" He says, "Why did you not go down to your house? Don't you want to see Bathsheba? I mean, I've never looked at her myself, but I heard she's pretty good looking." And look at what happens in verse 11. And Uriah said to David, "The ark, the ark." Look at it. Do you see that? That ought to jump off your page. Number one, he was a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ. The ark meant something to him. The ark was a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. The outside of the ark was laden with gold, speaking of his deity. The inside of the ark was acacia wood, which spoke of the humanity of Christ. The sins of the world were placed inside the Ark of the Covenant. The broken tablets of the Ten Commandments, Aaron's rod that budded, all of this. And it was put inside the box, and there was a lid on the top, known as the mercy seat. And there were two angels on the top of the box, and the two cherubim represented the justice of God and the righteousness of God. And once a year, the high priest would come in and pour blood on the Day of Atonement over the mercy seat, and the justice of God would judge the blood of the animal, and the righteousness of God would be satisfied. It was a type of the Lord Jesus Christ. The whole thing was a picture of the Lord Jesus Christ. And remember when God was present in the ark, the cloud was over the top of the tabernacle. Okay? So it's all of this is just a shadow. And look at what David says. Look at what Uriah says. First of all, he says, "Why didn't you go down to your house?" And Uriah said to David in verse 11, "The ark and Israel and Judah," that's the armies, "are staying in temporary shelters," those are tents, "and my lord Joab, the chief of staff, and the servants of my lord," those are the general officers, "David, are camped in the open field." This is the infantry. They're camped in the open field. And look at what he says. "Shall I then go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? By your life and by the life of your soul, I will not do this thing." That's integrity. That is amazing integrity. Hittites, fierce warriors, incredibly fierce warriors, but also incredibly loyal. And you know the sad story. Uriah actually carries his own death warrant back to Joab, and he's killed on the front lines of battle. Those are the Hittites. They're an awesome, and wouldn't it have been a shame to cram those the Phoenicians and the Hittites into 1 week? I mean, these guys were so, the Bible spent so much time. Now, you're going to see when you go home that I haven't even cracked the surface of it in this class. The handout that I gave you, we spent a lot of time putting a lot of additional information in there so that you can go home. And if you really want to crack the Hittite barrier, you can do it. Now, let me just give you a couple more things, and then we're going to go. We should talk about religion, okay? The Hittites had a religion, but again, typical of the Hittites, no one was persecuted or suffered any kind of penalty at all. Because of religion. You could worship whatever kind of religion you wanted to worship in the Hittite culture. Now, they did have a pantheon of gods, and it was probably very close to the same pantheon that was worshipped by the Phoenicians. After all, they're basically Hamitic peoples, okay? One of the most famous of these deities is, we know her as Diana, which is the Latinized version. It's actually Artemis. And in Acts chapter 19, you know that whole controversy that Paul never went anywhere without a controversy. But most people carrying the gospel are always in controversy anyway. So anyway, but he goes into Ephesus. Now, where's Ephesus? Asia Minor. He goes into Ephesus, which is one of the churches in Asia Minor. And while he's there, all of a sudden, the guys who are making the gods, The guys who are whittling the gods, you know, the craftsmen, all of a sudden they say, hey, do you know that, did you hear what Paul's been saying, Biff, about these gods? No, Chip, I haven't heard a thing about it. Well, what happens is he's actually saying that these little pieces of wood that we're carving are not God. And he goes, tell me you're lying. No, I'm not. I'm totally serious. Well, we've got to get the guild together. You know, when the guild gets together, there's always problems. So the guild gets together, and the union gets together, the idol makers union. We've been making idols in this town for a long time. And if you don't think we can move our business somewhere else, Smyrna's been looking for idols like this with this kind of quality for a long time now. We're not going to sit down and we're not going to put up with it. So basically, they get everybody together in the Colosseum. The whole population of Ephesus is in there. And they're all saying, you want us to leave? Do you want us to take our business somewhere else? And all the people are going, great is Diana. Great is Diana. You know, never mind. I was thinking of that Paul Anka song. Remember Diana? But anyway, great is Diana. Well, I don't know. Maybe we should get out of here. After all, you haven't been treating us very nice. Great is Diana. Right? So what happens? As a result, here's Paul. This is such a soup that Paul's colleagues won't even let... Paul, you don't even want to be there. Get out of there. You're not going to leave with your skin this time. You've been pushing your luck for a long time. Just get out of there. And you read it when you go home. You read Acts chapter 19. It's an amazing thing. But anyway, this Diana of Ephesus is also one of the seven wonders of the world. This temple that they built to her. One of the great wonders in the world. And it was probably imported from the Hittites. The Hittite Artemis is probably the same Artemis that was in... Ephesus. Okay, and lastly, religious freedom. They paralleled, the Hittites paralleled the United States as far as religious freedom. You would not be punished for worshiping whoever you decided that you wanted to worship, which is an amazing thing. Freedom, as I said, the same freedom that gives people to do certain things that we think are morally reprehensible is the same freedom that allows us to sit here today and worship our God, correct? So the thing is, it's very important. Whenever you see a nation that acknowledges freedom, it's something to definitely be praised. Let me see if I got that all now. Okay, what happens is, in closing, the Greek sea peoples end up coming, and they push about 1200 BC. They wipe out Boaz Kui, wipe it out, put a curse on it, and they move on. And what happens is many of the Hittites end up moving south into Palestine, what we know as Palestine. And these tribes are going to stay there, and they're going to stay fairly prominent until about in the 700s BC. And that's where we pick up next time with the Assyrians, because the final Hittites are wiped out by the most ferocious people who have, and I promise you, the most ferocious people who have ever walked on this planet, the Assyrians. They were too bad for words. I'm telling you, so many things we can't even say in this forum, you'd be disgusted. You'd probably be disgusted with the things we are going to say. But they were a brutal people. And you're going to understand when God talks to Jonah and he says, hey, just one thing, just do me a favor, go and talk to the Assyrians and tell them that to repent. Jonah's like, okay, here I am, here's Assyria, and he gets on a boat and he goes this way. And you know where he's headed? He's headed towards Tarshish, which is that place on the Iberian Peninsula that I was telling you about. You can read it in Jonah chapter 1. The place on the Iberian Peninsula where the Greek sea peoples founded a colony when those Dorians brought on that big intellectual movement during the Greek Dark Ages.